Hi, just before you listen to your 3CR podcast, a quick message. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. Thanks for listening and enjoy your podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by two returning guests, Dr. Emily M. Bender, a professor of linguistics at the University of Washington, and Dr. Alex Hanna, the director of research at the Distributed AI Research Institute, or DARE, and they are both the authors of The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. Alex, Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
I guess just to begin with, well, where to begin? Perhaps we could talk a little bit about what AI is, because I've been learning a lot about AI recently, and even some of the people promoting it will say things like some of the risks of using generative AI are that it will lie to you or that it will hallucinate. It strikes me that lying and hallucinating not things that a machine is actually capable of doing. Could you talk a little bit about the language that is used around AI?
Absolutely. So I would say AI is not a thing. The phrase AI or artificial intelligence is a marketing term that doesn't refer to a coherent set of technologies, but basically functions to raise money and interest from venture capitalists and sort of overpromise what systems can do. And then you're absolutely right to point out that even the way people describe some of the drawbacks of the technologies sold as AI is overselling what's going on. So in the book, we make a point of not using that term hallucination, first because it sort of makes light of what can be a serious symptom of mental disorders, but also because it suggests perceiving something that isn't there when in fact there's no perceiving going on at all. And similarly, lying is a word that means saying something that you know not to be the truth. And there's no knower inside of these chatbots or synthetic text extruding machines, nor any system that has any relationship to truth.
When my autocomplete on my phone tells me, you know, you want to say duck you, I don't think, oh, the little man at the top of the keyboard's on one today. Why is it that we think about these LLMs in a different way than we do, you know, autocomplete and
these great
simpler
question.
Technologies?
Yeah, I think it has to do, first of all, with scale. So the autocomplete on the phone is of a manageable scale, and you can play that game where you say, you type in, I'm sorry, I'm late, I, and then just like pick the middle choice. And you can see how you get different answers from your friends because you've been using your phones differently. And so you can sort of directly see that it's a reflection of what words you have been typing. But with the very large language models, first of all, it's an absolutely enormous amount of text that they're trained on from many, many different people. And so it's a little bit harder to like keep in mind where it's coming from. But then there's all of these design choices that are done by the companies making these to make them seem like there's a thinking entity inside. So the fact that it uses pronouns like I and me, or these days it'll have this little like something showing that it's thinking, which it isn't, of course, but like the UI suggests that that's going on. And I think all of that helps to build up the illusion.
Emily and Alex, we have obviously a lot of hype around AI, which includes attributing to it characteristics of which it's not capable of possessing. At the same time, we have others who speak of AI in terms of its doomer potential. It conceals all these malevolent forces that could be unleashed at any moment if we're not careful in how we treat this entity called AI. So how do you kind of reconcile this on the one hand, having a depiction of this technology that's kind of superhuman in a sense, and on the other, it being simply something that operates like another computer system that spits out kind of more or less what you put in.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, you know, we're really advertised to us that there's a spectrum of views on AI, one of these being that the tools that are typically associated with generative AI, so large language models primarily, and other things that have to do with language and manipulate language, are either posed as something that are going to be very powerful and are going to transform the economy, or they're going to tip over into consciousness and then take over the world and have to defend themselves, or they get optimized in a way that is all about perpetuating their kind. And so something we like to say is that there are two sides of the same coin. So the first view views AI as a thing, that it's inevitable, that it's all powerful, and it's going to change the world. And the doomers say that AI is a thing, it's inevitable, it's all powerful, and it's going to kill us all. And so both of them share a large set of assumptions, but you find many of the people that are in, let's say, the doomers view, people who work in AI development, who are building these technologies or built these technologies up to a point, and then they sort of freaked out and they saw something, you know, inside the computer or imputed with it a sort of agency. And so there is a lot more space. These folks occupy a corner of the possibilities of whatever, you know, map of positions you can have on technology sold as AI. And there's a lot more space, including refusal, including ridicule, including rejecting the kind of working conditions and products and services that we have to deal with at the end of the day.
One of the scenarios put forward by these doomers is something called paperclips, the idea that a machine tasked with producing as many paperclips as possible might decide that, I can put the interests of creating paperclips above the interests of humans, and humans are made up of atoms that could be paperclips. I'm just going to make as many paperclips as possible, which is obviously fanciful. Could there ever be a system that saw creating more of something as being above the interests of humanity and might chew up massive amounts of resources to do so?
Capitalism?
Yeah. I mean, if you read folks like Anna Singh, I mean, you know, her work is all about the work of capitalism and colonialism and sort of standardizing, you know, natural resources into things that are optimized toward, you know, to fulfill capitalist goals. And this metaphor of empire is extended by folks like Karen Howe, who in Empire of AI makes a lot of the same points, of kind of taking someone else's livelihood in order to have this kind of mythical abundance. And so this paperclip experiment is kind of what I'm getting at when we're talking about the kind of vision of these systems being quote unquote misaligned. This was originally put forth, or is usually attributed to, the author of a book called Superintelligence by this philosopher called Nick Bostrom, who's kind of the godfather of this ideology called long-termism. And so it's a really, absurd thought experiment. One of them firstly assumes that, you know, once you've gone to some place of having some system, it can self-replicate and kind of escape the machine, so it were, and then have a single-minded focus to turn us into paperclips, when, you know, it's a very silly and ridiculous thought experiment, and one that we think kind of has come up with somebody that maybe never had to do system administration for computers, doesn't really understand what kind of a runaway system may really look like in practice. But it's also, you know, has this goal in mind, and it sets up this as the most virtuous thing you can do to engage in what's called AI alignment, which is to bring AI, quote unquote, in alignment with, quote unquote, human values, as if that is a unified and singular thing.
Also, seems like someone who's never needed a paperclip and not been able to find one. A few years ago, there was something called the AI pause letter, where various people from across big tech came out and said, we need to just press pause on developing any further generative AI. I noticed that one of those signatories, Elon Musk, has continued developing his AI Grok, or Mecha Hitler, as it likes to be called. In fact, one of the developers of that system has referred to it as building the Antichrist. What's going on with Elon Musk and his lack of pausing?
Well, can't really speak to what's going on inside of Elon Musk, but the pause letter really just struck us as another hype artifact. It was basically a way of building up how powerful these systems are supposed to be and also directing attention away from the real harms that are happening now. So shortly after that came out, Dr. Timit Gebru, Dr. Angelina McMillan Major, and Dr. Meg Mitchell and I, as the listed authors of the Stochastic Parrots paper, wrote a response, which is available on the web. And our TLDR at the top of that is, the harms from so-called AI are real and present and follow from the acts of people and corporations deploying automated systems. Regulatory efforts should focus on transparency, accountability, and preventing exploitative labor practices. And that's where the focus really ought to be. And all of this song and dance about, oh, we have to pause the development of systems, you know, more powerful than XYZ, is really just another doomerist narrative. And as I was saying, another way of trying to promulgate the idea that these systems are unbelievably powerful instead of just unbelievably exploitative.
Well, there's been much hype around AI and a lot of discussion about its potentially disastrous impacts upon humanity, as you've just said, Emily. One of the things that this obscures is the actual impacts that so-called AI is having in the here and now. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little more on how AI is affecting workplaces, and in particular, its impacts upon law, healthcare, and education.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a few different ways, you know, that we can discuss this. One of them is a notion that generative AI can replace people on the job. And so the big problem that generative AI is posed to many employers is that we're going to see incredible gains in efficiency. And so we see this in everything from the clinician's office to legal firms to schools to big tech firms that, you know, Microsoft and Amazon say that their employees have to, or have at least made allusions to, their employees have to, or are implementing this all over their workplace. And so first off, that is not true. There's limited evidence in experimental settings that it improves that let's say code generation improves developer outputs. And there's also evidence that people think that they're doing more with less, but they're just doing less. It's actually impeding coding activities. There's a study that came out of its collaboration between University of Chicago and Copenhagen Business School, which had looked at workers across 7,000 workplaces and effectively found no, or rather limited, productivity improvements. And those were offset by the new tasks that generative AI introduced in the workplace. And so first, the things that are actually happening in workplaces, that firms are being sold on AI and they're going in whole hog, and workers are bearing the brunt of it, either by work intensification or having their colleagues laid off because they say that AI can do some of these things, which it cannot. And in the area of law, we're seeing many cases in which firms are being sold on generative AI being able to do things like summarization of texts and writing of briefs. And we kind of see day after day so many lawyers being dinged by stuff like made-up cases that are leading to nowhere. And there's been more than one firm that is, at least one firm that we know, we talked about on our podcast, that has chastised their lawyers and said, if you're going to use these things, you know, double check these cases and make sure they exist. in healthcare, we're seeing it in a lot of different areas, including claims processing, including adjudicating the level of care someone may need, whether they're patient acuity levels or triage. And these are awful, awful kinds of areas where we would be using any kind of automated decision-making systems unless there is sufficient human oversight. That's certainly not the case here.
We're seeing a lot of a really big push, I think, in the US and the UK. I don't know the situation in Australia. I'm hoping it's better for you there, where the people selling this technology really want to sell it to educational institutions, both because there's actually a pot of money there to go after, and also because it's a way to get your hands on lots and lots of data. And it's really just the idea is that a chatbot or what you might call a conversation simulator could provide personalized tutoring to students and like patiently explain things in many different ways is actually anathema to what education is about, because it ends up with students getting sort of bespoke misinformation. You end up with, instead of having a community of learners, you have students glued to a screen. And I think probably the worst part of it in terms of just what's happening in the classroom is that it is presenting knowledge as this thing that just exists objectively in the world. And any question you have has a knowable answer that is knowable from this like omniscient point of view, rather than helping students become critical thinkers who understand that anything they are reading comes from a viewpoint and can sort of build up their sense of the information ecosystem and how those various sources speak to each other, which is really what we need to be doing in education.
Sam Altman of OpenAI once tweeted, "I'm a stochastic parrot and so are you." I also recently saw, I think, somebody from Google in the comments on Y Combinator or something saying, are our eyes not just prompts for our brains? What's the difference between a human brain and an LLM if we're just bringing in information and putting out output? Could you speak a little bit about that concept?
These people have such a dismal, impoverished idea of what it is to be human and also of what other people are. So that tweet from Sam Altman came out, I think, in December of 22, so not too long after the launch of ChatGPT and 2 years after we published the Stochastic Parrots paper. But because he's extremely famous, it means that a lot of people now attribute that phrase to him, where it's mine, just for the record. But also, like, what really gets me exercised here is this, someone making that claim is basically saying, I don't believe anybody around me has any internal life. And I don't believe that when they're speaking, they're doing it because they have an idea they want to communicate. I think they are just coming up with a likely next word. And I suspect that this comes from not only a really dismal and impoverished view of what it is to be human, but also this really big desire to elevate what they've created with these large language models into something human-like, but they're not. And so the move available to them is to try to minimize what it is to be human in order to make them equivalent.
It sort of reminds me of the meme you often see on the far right of the NPC, that all of these other people are non-player characters.
Yeah, very much so.
In the book, you look at the ways in which we consider intelligence, and particularly, I guess, the racist history of the concept of intelligence. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this notion of general intelligence is quite dark, and it goes back to this history of IQ testing in particular. And so in the book, we talk about Alfred Binet. It's a French psychologist who is developing tests to find ways to aid children who had been falling behind in their schooling. However, folks in the US took this measure and ran with it as developing a singular metric for intelligence. And any kind of time you try to metricize intelligence, it's cause for alarm. This is a process that Stephen Jay Gould calls reification. So the kind of ability to take intelligence as a single thing on a single axis and quantify it and then stack rank people. And so folks around the turn of the century had taken this metric and tried to hone it for a test that could be used. And quite quickly, it had been used to stack rank in the UK, used to stack rank people who are mentally disabled, and then in the US, stack rank people according to ethnicity and race. And so this kind of measure of intelligence then has always been a eugenicist project in the UK, used to enact programs of non-consensual sterilization, of non-consensual institutionalization in the US, of miscegenation laws, legislation around also non-consensual sterilization. And so the fact that, you know, there is not really this single metric of intelligence in cognitive science. I mean, cognitive sciences seem to indicate that there's many different types of intelligence, and stack ranking individuals is going to lead down a dark history very quickly and supports eugenicist ends. But this is kind of the closest thing to which many people in the AI space reach to when they try to put some kind of number to intelligence. You know, it can do this well on an IQ test, which seems to signify X, Y, and Z. Now that there's not a reference to IQ, but to levels of education, our agent is at the PhD level, and it's going to help you do everything that a PhD can do, which is very funny to those of us with PhDs. And so it's got that huge problem, and you've got that nexus of people who are out and out eugenicists, people like Mark Andreessen, people like Elon Musk. Mark Andreessen said, you know, there needs to be more progeny being created by people in developed countries. He's come out and said more extreme things, but this is the one that comes to mind because we have it in the book. Elon Musk is, of course, you know, there's not much to say about him anymore. And I feel like we wrote the book trying to find these kind of indications of fascism in Elon Musk, and then he just did a Hitler salute at the inauguration. So it's one of those instances like, oh, we spent this long writing the book and he just tweeted it. So, you know, there's clearly these connections between the tech brolicarchy vision and the kind of ideological bases on which these tools are built.
Alex and Emily, how AI, or what's termed AI, came to be is an interesting story, but how is it that these technologies have developed seemingly on the basis of harvesting unlawfully vast amounts of personal data from across the web and not be subject to regulation? What's the situation with regards how these sorts of corporations and their projects are being regulated now, and what do you see in the near future?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a bit of a legal gray area in terms of whether these data are harvested legally or illegally off the web. A lot of that has to do with copyright and intellectual property regulation. And so this has been a kind of a gray area in the law for quite some time. It's been litigated in the US at the margins through things like Google image search and different kinds of summaries provided on platforms. And now we're having a bevy of cases that are attempting to address that in this legal gray area. So the New York Times has filed suit against OpenAI. Disney has taken on Midjourney. And then there's a whole host of smaller, lesser known cases. And so this all kind of hangs on this principle of fair use, which suggests that some of these cases are within the boundaries of a fair use exemption. And so we're not lawyers, so we don't know where that's going to go, but it's working its way through the courts in the US, and I imagine in different countries as well. Talking about regulation writ large, there's a bit of regulation that has to deal with AI. In the US, the situation is pretty abysmal, unfortunately. At the national level, there's no national level AI legislation, but more alarmingly, there's no federal privacy legislation around personal data. And so in the EU, there's legislation like the General Data Protection Regulation, which provides a few guarantees for people and their representations in the data, and under which Italy had, under their data regulator, had prevented ChatGPT, but now they have some, they kind of had elements in working with the Italian data regulator to push ChatGPT into that market. And then the EU also has the EU AI Act, which prohibits a few high-risk instances of automated decision systems. But it still has some pretty big gaps in that, including some high-risk uses for law enforcement and border control and technology. Overall, it's rather worrying because these companies have huge lobbying arms and have been able to push through a lot of orientation towards pretty much light touch or hands-off regulation, especially in the U.S., and we're seeing a lot of that happen in other countries as well.
I just want to add that another really important kind of regulation in the current state of affairs is regulation around power and water usage, because as data centers are going in, and there's wonderful description of the pushback to this and also the harms in Karen Howe's book, Empire of AI, that Alex mentioned earlier, these are the hyperscale data centers place enormous demands on electricity and also clean water. And they seem to be going into places where these things are poorly regulated. And so any community that is being approached by one of these folks to site one of these systems or the data centers in their community, drawing on their power and water, should really take a really hard look at how to shore up the regulation to protect those resources for people rather than this very wasteful computation.
Emily and Alex, I don't think either of you have an MBA, neither do Andy or I, so we may all be unqualified to answer this question. But it seems to me that perhaps an industry that requires spending hundreds of billions of dollars for very little profit, it's not an especially sustainable one, but again, no MBA, so I could be wrong. Is the AI bubble about to burst?
I mean, we're not oracles. I mean, it looked like it's been about to burst for over a year now, and we're getting into places where it's looking more and more like it's going to. And I mean, it seems like whenever we look up these numbers, it looks more and more like it's teetering on precarity. So I know just the capital expenditure of this is just flooring. I think we recorded our podcast this morning, and one of the people that we had on, I think it was Kate Brennan, who is associate director of AI Now, mentioned how there's been $300 billion in investment in new data center projects. And I don't know over what time period, but it's just this huge investment in this, and it's just a giant capital expenditure. And as you rightly point out, there's very little profit in this. And then, I mean, I don't have an MBA, but you know, I don't think that makes me unqualified to speak on this and say that seems like a bad deal. And I think the promise, I mean, this is, you know, the kind of promise here is that there's going to be one day where it really starts making a profit, is that you have a case, and Brian Merchant in his most recent newsletter, I think he makes an analogy to the railroad barons. You've laid down the track, and once you get that first train running, you're really going to be in business. But you know, but the thing about this is, where's that train? We've had this for so long. The proof is supposed to be in the pudding, and yet no one's able to be more productive with these tools. It hasn't had this revolution in productivity of, you know, 10, 20% industrial revolution type levels. So where is this coming from? And for us, it's just all vibes. And so I don't really know how the bubble bursts, but at one point it's going to, and it's looking more and more like it's going to be catastrophic when it does.
Yeah. And, you know, we finished our book in September of last year. And it really felt like the bubble couldn't possibly get bigger. It had to be about to burst then. And so we thought, you know, it'll be a better world if our book isn't needed when it hits the shelves in May of 25. Unfortunately, we didn't get that better world. And again, I'm also not an MBA, but it seems to me that part of the way that this bubble is getting as big as it is that it is starting from an enormous concentration of wealth. And so the venture capitalists have a lot of money and also some of the big tech firms that they can keep pumping into this, even though they're getting no returns.
Of course, the rest of the economy being propped up on this bubble is certainly not going to be a problem.
Yeah, no, it's a huge issue, right? And I mean, it's, you know, yeah, looking at Brian's newsletter and a bit of the reporting he was talking about there is how Microsoft has become the second company after NVIDIA with a $4 trillion valuation. And I mean, it's very much, you know, just complete vibes here. And, you know, it's sort of the big, you know, these big companies, especially the hyperscalers, and then NVIDIA, the one that is turning out the shovels for the AI gold rush, are driving so much of the world economy right now. And that's really, really terrifying. And I'm not really sure what's in investors' minds and not seeing how precarious this is to put all market investment in a single vertical, but they're really playing with fire right now.
In the book, you talk a bit about the history of the Luddites. And, you know, Luddite has become this slur for someone who's change resistant to new technologies, but it actually has an interesting history, which is repeating almost exactly as history tends to do. Could you tell us a little bit about who the Luddites were and what they actually did?
Yeah, so the Luddites were this movement and based in, oh gosh, in 1800s in Europe, specifically in Nottingham, England, and they had been opposing the introduction of these power looms, these looms that had been were basically scaling up the weaving of fabrics for stockings and hose and whatnot. And this had been before this era, more of a artisanal craft-based profession. And the owners of these power looms wanted to introduce them and scale up production of these products. And so the Luddites bound together under a mythical figure named Ned Ludd and would go under the cover of night and smash these power looms and, you know, nail a note to the door and said, you know, this is, you know, we have done this. The people who did this was Ned Ludd or Ned Ludd's army, or my favorite, Ned Ludd's wives in one account. So they actually will disguise themselves in women's clothing and run out and smash looms. And this is done to prevent this kind of incursion of these tools, which also relied on, you know, really terrible labor conditions, often child labor, grueling work days, and really upset the local economies and the production of these materials. And so the Luddites themselves were not anti-technology per se, but they knew what the technology would do for their livelihoods. And so the discourse in the term Luddites is, you know, we don't, you know, something that we reiterate again and again is that Luddites were not anti-technology, but they're anti these robber barons coming into their communities, taking these technologies, which are fundamentally anti-worker, doing it in ways that were dangerous for workers and in upsetting local economies, and then wanting to safeguard their profession as a craft profession. So that's a little about the Luddites. And we've seen just a real big resurgence in interest in the Luddites, especially with more and more automated tools being developed. And there have been some really interesting histories of the Luddites written by Gavin Mueller, who has a book called Breaking Things at Work, and Brian Merchant's Blood in the Machine, and Jathan Sadowski's The Luddite and the Mechanic. So there's been a lot of interest in this. And I think there's, you know, a tradition that we could kind of take inspiration from.
Emily and Alex, the subtitle of the book is How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. In reading over that, there's obviously many responses on an individual and collective basis that can be made to help implode this myth and enable people to fight back against the repressive uses to which so-called AI is put. There's also a reference to libraries as being a community resource. I'm wondering if you can maybe speak to the kinds of public resources that are available currently and how people can utilize them to fight back against this hype and these technologies.
Sure. So I think that in many ways, the core of fighting back is solidarity. And that's both in sort of a labor movement context, but also in just community building in general. And that's where libraries are a particularly interesting site. And in that reference, we're building on the work of Anna Lauren Hoffman and Raina Bloom, who talk about the sort of library as a community-based service profession, you know, being a librarian versus, this is a paper from I think 2016 or so, Google's view of, you know, making all the world's information accessible. And well, what do they mean accessible, right? You can sit at your computer and you can put in a query and you can get back the crappy AI overview and lots of SEO stuff. But even when it's working well, not everyone is prepared to interact with information that way. But what a library is, it's a place of community and a place where you can connect with a person who, if they are sufficiently supported by the community around them, is paid to help you navigate your information needs. And those points of connection and that sort of being in community together is a hugely important part of pushing back against big tech's project and their hype.
That was probably a more positive way of framing the question I was going to ask. How do we smash up these looms?
I do think we can smash up these looms. There's a project, actually, it's funny you mentioned that. I feel like I should talk about it a little bit, called the Luddite Lab that I've been working on at DEAR. And a little bit of it is trying to extend that kind of history to Luddites, try to think about in the kind of legacy of the Luddites. Specifically, I'm trying to think about what are kind of modes of resistance. And there's this term that I love from this philosopher, Blair Attard Frost, who's a philosopher and scholar in Canada. And he has this notion of counter-governance and AI counter-governance. And so we have this kind of idea of AI governance, which I think has been one of these kind of mealy-mouthed capture terms. And I like her term counter-governance because it gives a sense of thinking about ways in which we can create these counter-publics or counter-structures in which, in the absence of real teeth from legislators and regulators, like in the U.S., we can create alternative sites of democracy. And so one of them I see are labor organizations, so unions, and there have been many unions that have embraced really active counter-governance to AI. One of them is the Association of American University Professors, or AAUP, came out with a great document, a report on AI and how their members are viewing it within the university. And it really, really pushes this kind of idea of in the need for understanding what these systems are doing and promoting kind of governments and governance from faculty and contingent faculty on how these tools are used in the classroom, and also intervening when universities procure these tools and having some kind of intervention in the buying process itself. There's also organizations like the National Nurses United who have fought for technological oversight and the introduction of new technology, especially in the hospital setting. And then the Writers Guild of America, who after their 148-day strike, were able to get strong protections against having to deal with generative AI output in the writer's room in Hollywood and TV and film writing. And so I really am inspired by these organizations that have really built these counter-governance structures, because they know that the kind of thing that quote-unquote AI is supposed to threaten is their livelihoods. It's supposed to solve for wages, as someone on Blue Sky put it. And some, you know, CEOs have been quite blatant about it. They said, I think there was someone on LinkedIn that said something like, yeah, AI doesn't strike. It doesn't ask for breaks, et cetera, et cetera. So it's quite clear what the stakes are for many people, especially in professions that deal with text or images or video. And so, you know, I think those counter-governance structures like labor organizations and the lessons that we learn from the Luddites are really important ones we can look to right now.
Well, Emily and Alex, we'll have to leave it there. The book is The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. You, of course, also produce the podcast Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000, which is a must listen. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us again.
Well, Andy, that is our program. We will be back next week. See you later.
See you then.
On the 12th of October, we will be marching and commemorating 2 years of genocide, 2 years of resistance, and 2 years of steadfastness. The Palestinian people here in Naam and the community will be marching together. We invite you all to join us and stand side by side to call for justice for the Palestinian people in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in Nablus, in Niafa, and in all the cities. We have been marching for the last 103 weeks back to back, calling for justice for Palestine and calling to sanction Israel. It is our duty to stand together with the oppressed. Join us on Sunday, 12th of October, at the State Library, 12 o'clock. And remember, always, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Standing Together for Public Housing is a campaign to stop the privatisation of public housing. Come to a public meeting at 6 p.m. on the 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre to have your say on how to maintain and build more public housing instead of knocking it down. 6 p.m. Thursday, 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre, 113 Swanson Street, Melbourne. For more details, see the Standing Together for Public Housing Facebook page. The Public Housing Campaign is a 3CR supporter.